Welcome and thank you for standing by. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Mr. Brian Testa, you may now begin.
Thank you. Good evening or good morning to everybody. This call and this WebEx is meant to give an overview of the CW1 temporary labor certification program. As many of you know, the department was just able to place into public inspection today the interim final rule that will enact the temporary labor certification portion of the CW1 program. And we will hopefully answer most of the questions that you have about this program. I will just alert you that we have created a CW1 page on the OFLC website. So if you visit our website, foreignlaborcert.doleta.gov, and that will be in on the last slide of the presentation. So if you didn't get that, it will be there for you to view and to write down later. But we will we're posting information there now. We will continue to post additional information, but there is already a good amount of information there that will also hopefully be able to guide you through this program. I am joined this evening by my colleague, Liana Miranda-Valido, and she will help me in this presentation. I will do approximately the first half, and she will do the second half. We are now going to get started. The two offices that for sort of a, I guess, an overview of the Office of Foreign Labor Certification, for those of you who aren't aware, we are a component of the U.S. Department of Labor, and we have three processing centers, one focused on temporary applications, one focused on perm green card applications, and one that assigns and reviews prevailing wage determinations for all of our programs except for one. And the two centers that are relevant to the CW1 program are the National Prevailing Wage Center, which, again, issues prevailing wages, and everybody who is filing a CW1 application will need to obtain a prevailing wage from the NPWC before submitting an application for the temporary labor certification, and the Chicago National Processing Center, which reviews and grants or doesn't grant, as the case may be, temporary labor certifications, including for the CW1 program. The various topics we're going to go over tonight are the statutory and regulatory background of the program, the program requirements, an overview of prevailing wage determinations, an overview of preparing and submitting temporary labor certification applications, as well as the process for review and final determinations of those TLC applications, post-certification activities, and then a list of important resources, which includes the OFLC website, which I mentioned earlier. The Northern Marianas Workforce Act of 2018 was signed into law in July 2018, and it is the law that requires a temporary labor certification become part of the overall application for the existing CW1 visa. The intent of the law is to encourage the hiring of U.S. workers in CNMI and also to ensure that no U.S. worker is placed at a competitive disadvantage compared to non-U.S. workers or is displaced by a non-U.S. worker. And it requires a twofold finding by the department in order to issue a temporary labor certification. The department must both confirm that no sufficient U.S. workers in the CNMI are able, willing, qualified, and available at the time and place needed by the employer for the job opportunity, and that the employment of non-immigrant workers will not adversely affect the wages and working conditions of similarly employed U.S. workers. The statute also requires the department to publish the interim final rule, which we placed into public inspection today and will be published on Monday, April 1st, Eastern Time. And the department, as many of you are probably aware, this rule was due to be published a couple of months ago. And while the department did what it could to get the rule published in a timely manner, the government shutdown, unfortunately, prevented other agencies from being able to review and comment on the rule, and from the Office of Management and Budget from being able to approve it, which is what's led to this delay. In order to implement this program, we have created two new forms which will be used for all applications. The ETA 9141C, which is the application which will be filed with the National Prevailing Wage Center to obtain a prevailing wage determination, and the ETA 9142C, which is the application for a temporary employment certification that will be submitted to the Chicago National Processing Center. Again, this the regulation just sort of puts into place what's already codified as what the department must determine when issuing a TLC, so I won't go over that a second time. One of the key features of the IFR is that it implements a number of worker protections to ensure that U.S. workers are protected, and also to ensure that CW workers are also protected. No U.S. worker should be placed at a competitive disadvantage compared to a non-U.S. worker, nor displaced by a non-U.S. worker. And the IFR, or regulation, I'll use those terms interchangeably, does not allow for such an action to be taken. The layoff of any similarly employed U.S. worker may not U.S. workers may not be laid off within 270 calendar days of the date of need for the job, and U.S. workers may also, in similarly employed U.S. workers, may also not be laid off during the certification period. The job opportunity must be full-time, which means a minimum of 35 hours per week. All wages must be paid final and unconditionally and free and clear of any charges as defined by the department's wage and hour regulations, and the payment of wages may not be any less frequent than every 2 weeks. And employers are required to offer and provide U.S. workers no less than the same benefits, wages, and working conditions that the employer is offering, intends to offer, or will provide to CW1 workers. Employers, however, are not precluded from offering U.S. workers a higher wage rate or more generous benefits or working conditions. To ensure that U.S. workers are protected from the hiring of CW1 workers, or U.S. workers in corresponding employment must be paid the same wages and benefits as those paid to CW1 workers. And what corresponding employment means is the employment of U.S. workers by a CW1 employer in any work included in the approved job opportunity or in any work performed by the CW1 workers. And just to be very clear what that means that if a U.S. worker is performing any duty performed by a CW1 worker or any duty that's listed in the application filed with the department, the U.S. worker will be considered to be in corresponding employment. Employers are responsible for paying fees that are generally viewed as being to the benefit of the employer. This includes visa and related fees for CW1 workers, though it does not include the payment of fees for obtaining a passport, which is considered to be for the benefit primarily of the individual that holds the passport. Inbound transportation and subsistence costs of CW1 workers who complete 50% of the job order must be paid, and this is both CW1 workers and U.S. workers in corresponding employment. Outbound transportation and subsistence costs of workers who complete the entire job order period, also including U.S. workers in corresponding employment, must be paid as well by employers. The regulations also seek to ensure that there is transparency and integrity in the program. This means that employers must give clear earning statements on or before each payday to all workers with the hours worked and offered and the deductions that are clearly specified so that it's clear that any deductions are lawful deductions. And employers must provide copies of the work contract in the language understood by the worker no later than the time that the offer of employment is made. The regulations also establish a sanctions and penalties regime for employers that violate program requirements, such as more intensive or assistant recruitment requirements, revocation of a certified application for temporary employment certification, or debarment from all OFLC employment-based programs for a period of up to 5 years. The department is in the process of rolling out a new web-based application system through which applications will be filed. And the system is called the Foreign Labor Application Gateway, or FLAG, and it is being introduced with the CW1 program. CW1 employers, agents, and attorneys will use this system to create accounts, request prevailing wage determinations, file CW1 applications, submit documents related to their applications, view the case status, and access their applications for any reason that they may have. The system, or the URL for the FLAG system is here. It's https://flag.dol.gov. And the system will be going live shortly, but the submit button will be grayed out until April 4th at midnight Eastern time, which is the time at which the IFR will become effective and employers will therefore be able to start filing with the Department of Labor. The first step in filing for a temporary labor certification for CW1 is to obtain a prevailing wage determination from the Prevailing Wage Center, and the general purpose of the prevailing wage is to ensure that foreign workers are not being paid less than U.S. workers, which goes to one of the department's mandates to ensure that the employment of CW1 workers is not undercutting the wages or working conditions of similarly employed U.S. workers. And unlike in many of our other programs, the Workforce Act very specifically details how a prevailing wage will be determined in the CW1 program. The CNMI governor has the ability to conduct an occupational wage survey that meets the statistical standards that are laid out by the Department of Labor on an annual basis. And if the governor chooses to conduct such a survey, and they're not required to do so, but if the governor does do so, then any occupation for which there's a valid survey wage from the governor will be deemed to be the prevailing wage for the occupation. And just for efficiency purposes and just to make it clear that there has been a survey that was conducted by the CNMI Department of Commerce that recently expired, but it was used predominantly for the H-2B program. And all of the survey standards that are in this IFR are the same as the survey standards for the H-2B program. So there's only one survey that needs to be conducted. So hopefully that will allow the survey process to be more efficient for CNMI and for the governor. And the Workforce Act, as I said, requires that the survey be conducted annually, which is a more stringent requirement than OFLC requires in its other foreign labor certification programs. And as a result of that, the most recent survey, as I mentioned, that's been used predominantly for H-2B has expired and cannot currently be used for the CW1 program because the data involved is too old. However, we are working closely with the CNMI Department of Commerce and other representatives of the CNMI government to get a to help them conduct a survey that meets the requirements for the IFR. And in fact, there was a call yesterday, last night, Eastern time, between our National Prevailing Wage Center and individuals in the CNMI government who will be conducting the survey to provide technical assistance and help them get started with the survey process. So it's our understanding that that process is moving quickly. However, because there is not a currently valid survey, the statute requires that the prevailing wage be the mean wage, the mean arithmetic wage of wages similarly employed in the territory of Guam based on the Occupational Employment Statistics Survey conducted by DOL's Bureau of Labor Statistics. And when I say similarly employed, what that means is the occupational classification, the standard occupational classification, which is a 6 or 8-digit code that will be assigned by the National Prevailing Wage Center. And that's assigned irrespective of what the wage source is that's being used to determine the prevailing wage. And the third statutory requirement is that in no case may the prevailing wage be any lower than either the United States or CNMI minimum wage, whichever is the highest. In order to obtain a prevailing wage determination, the prevailing wage application, the 9141C, must be submitted electronically to the Department of Labor. And with the exception of emergency situations, for which there is a specific provision in the regulations, employers must request and obtain a prevailing wage before they submit a temporary labor certification application to the Chicago National Processing Center. The department encourages requests for PWDs to be submitted at least 90 calendar days before the date that the PWD is needed. Now, we realize that with the publication of the IFR, that's not going to be the case this year, and we will work as expeditiously as possible to turn around prevailing wage determinations for CNMI employers. But going forward, please keep in mind that it's recommended that if you apply at least 90 calendar days before you need the prevailing wage determination, you should almost certainly have it way before you need it, and it's just one less worry that you'll have when filing the TLC. OFLC will annually, or as new surveys are reviewed, because the CNMI governor could conduct one omnibus survey that covers all occupations, but they may also, or he or she may also conduct more targeted surveys, so we may receive more than one survey from the governor. There will only be one survey wage for each occupation, but as new surveys become available, we will update the listing of occupations for which there is a valid survey wage. Something else that the department is doing is that, as I mentioned, where there's not a survey wage, the Guam OES wage will be assigned. OES wages come in 4 levels depending on sort of how localized the survey was able to be in terms of deciding a wage. And the survey may require that the geographic location of a survey be expanded in order to get valid survey data from which to generate a prevailing wage. And that could include nationwide wages, which we understand are far higher than anything that would reasonably be expected to be paid in CNMI. So in cases where there's not a wage specific to Guam, but rather it's based on an expanded geographic location, the department will adjust the wage based on the percentage difference between Guam's specific wages and the national wages. And those adjusted wages will also be listed on the OFLC website. So employers will know which occupations don't have a Guam specific wage, but rather an expanded wage, which has been discounted, and they will be able to see all of those wages on the OFLC website as well. To request a prevailing wage, as I mentioned, employers must electronically file the 9141C through the FLAG system. There are two very limited exceptions to electronic filing, but we expect that virtually all applications will be filed electronically. And as, you know, just as a point of fact, that is, seems like it would be far more efficient for CNMI employers so that they don't have to worry about mail time and things of that nature. The only exceptions to the electronic filing requirement are either lack of internet access or a physical disability which prevents a filer from using the FLAG system. In those instances, the application will be mailed in and a statement must be included with the mailed-in application explaining why the filer needs to file by mail. Any mailed-in applications that do not include such a statement will be returned without review. As I mentioned earlier, the PW for each occupation is based on either the CNMI government wage or the OES wage, and we are currently working closely with the CNMI governor on the survey. There is no appeal of the survey decision which OFLC makes in terms of whether or not the survey is statistically valid. However, in cases or for occupations where OFLC decides that the survey wage is not statistically valid, the CNMI governor would be able to correct their survey or provide additional information which may lead to a different decision. After reviewing the 9141C, OFLC will issue a prevailing wage based on the following manner. Again, is just to reiterate, the first preference is for a survey from the governor of Guam at the arithmetic mean wage from the governor of CMI. If that's not available, the Guam OES wage. And if the Guam OES wage is based on an expanded wage, then an adjusted Guam OES wage, which will be issued. And if there is more than one occupational classification, so say the job is considered to be a combination of a housekeeper and a janitor, then whichever occupation has the higher level wage is what will be assigned. And OFLC will issue the prevailing wage indicating the source, validity period, and return the form with its endorsement to the employer. And there is no regulatory or statutory processing requirement. However, the department, again, understands the urgency, especially this year, of issuing prevailing wage determinations as quickly as possible. And as I said earlier, we will process applications as expeditiously as we can. After obtaining the prevailing wage determination, the employer will then be able to file a TLC application with the Chicago National Processing Center. Again, this application will be filed electronically using the FLAG system, and the same exceptions apply to filing mailed-in applications for the TLC application as for the prevailing wage. One thing I would point out is that if the employer files a paper application with its explanation for the prevailing wage determination, it does not need to file a separate request to file paper-based for the TLC. So the only time that you would need to file the statement indicating a need to file by mail with a mailed-in TLC application is if circumstances have changed since you obtained a prevailing wage and there's now an inability to file electronically that had previously not been the case. When filing a CW-1 temporary labor certification application, the employer needs the following: a valid prevailing wage determination case number, the ETA 9142C, and the applicable appendices to the 9142C. So if the employer is a job contractor, they must file Appendix A to the 9142C. If they are not a job contractor, that appendix does not need to be filed and should not be filed. If the employer has additional work sites, then they must file Appendix B. And again, if there are not additional work sites, then that appendix need not and should not be filed. Every employer needs to sign and submit Appendix C, which is the assurances and obligations, basically the employer saying that they understand all the assurances to workers and obligations that they have for receiving a CW-1 temporary labor certification, and submit that to the department. Now, and they must also submit supporting documentation. The nice thing about using the FLAG system is you will answer questions and select check boxes that are relevant to the application. So if you are not a job contractor and you do not have additional work sites, then Appendix A and Appendix B will not even be something that the system asks you to fill out. So by using FLAG, you don't need to worry about submitting forms that you need not submit. And on the flip side, you also won't forget to submit documents or forms that you need to submit, because the system will not allow you to submit an application that is incomplete. Just here's a quick checklist to remember when you're filing your application. Obtain a PWD except in emergency situations, which we will discuss later. Complete the 9142C and appropriate appendices. Ensure that all required fields are completed, which are those that have an asterisk. And again, the FLAG system will make sure you do that. Sign the Appendix C. And for the emergency filing, follow the emergency filing requirements. And please note that incomplete applications will be returned without review by CNPC, although, again, it's unlikely that there will be an incomplete application unless it's filed by paper, in which case there are the other requirements that we just discussed. Here are the filing timeframes for a temporary labor certification, and these are in the Workforce Act. So these are something that are, this is statutory and something that we have no ability to waive under any circumstances. If the employer is filing for a CW for workers who are not currently in CW-1 status, they may not file any earlier than 120 calendar days prior to the employer's date of need. And for dates of need starting on October 1st, which is what we expect most will be, the employer may not file any earlier than June 3rd, 2019 at midnight Eastern time. And for applications that are extending the CW-1 status of somebody who's already in that status, the employer may not file any earlier than 180 calendar days before the date of need, or before the CW-1 status expires. Now, this year, that's not really going to be an issue because the IFR doesn't go into effect until April 4th, which is 180 days before the date of need. But in future years, the employer won't be able to file their TLC with Chicago until 180 days before the date of need, although, again, they can submit their prevailing wage application and are encouraged to do so well ahead of the filing date so that you have that ready to go. I've mentioned emergency situations a few times, and what that means is that the certifying officer at the Chicago National Processing Center may waive the requirement that the employer obtain a prevailing wage determination prior to filing the TLC application with Chicago based on a showing of good and substantial cause for doing so by the employer. If the employer is filing requesting emergency procedures, they must file both a completed 9141C to CNPC, not to the National Prevailing Wage Center, and a statement justifying the waiver of the normal prevailing wage requirement. Now, something to keep in mind is that if the employer submits an ETA 91, it submits without a prevailing wage requesting emergency procedures, and the emergency procedures are not accepted, if the employer does not show good and substantial cause, the whole application will be returned to the employer and they will need to start over and obtain a prevailing wage before they can move forward. Good and substantial cause includes things like a substantial loss of U.S. workers attributed to acts of God or similar unforeseeable man-made catastrophic events, unforeseen changes in market conditions, pandemic health issues, or similar conditions that are wholly outside the employer's control, such as government flooding or a hazardous material emergency. The following do not constitute good and substantial cause: the publication and implementation of this IFR. So just to be absolutely clear, every employer filing a CW1 TLC this year, starting on April 4th when this rule goes into effect, will need to submit a prevailing wage request to MPWC and obtain a prevailing wage determination before submitting the temporary labor certification application to Chicago. If you don't have that and you try to use the new regulation as good and substantial cause, your request will be denied. And it should be noted that there is no appeal provision for good and substantial cause. That is solely at the discretion of the CNPC certifying officer. Other examples that do not constitute good and substantial cause are the CW1 visa cap and denial of an application by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. CW1 TLCs are available only for places of employment on CNMI. If you list or try to list a work site that's not on CNMI, this flag system shouldn't allow you to file. If somehow you trick the system into letting you file, the application will be returned because the job simply will not qualify for a CW1 visa. Generally, the period of employment for a CW1 is up to 1 year. There is an exception to that in the statute, and that is for long-term CW1 workers who may receive a temporary labor certification for up to 3 years. And the statute defines a long-term CW1 worker as somebody who was admitted during fiscal year 2015 in CW1 status and continued in CW1 status through fiscal years 2016, 2017, and 2018. Just as a note, because this is sort of a strange situation, but if you're able to obtain a long-term CW1 worker, that worker is actually, even though the labor cert is issued for 3 years, the worker is counted individually against the cap each year. So it's not some sort of cap exemption. It's just allows for a longer time without having to obtain a new TLC. Applications may be filed for multiple petitions so long as the job duties, the job requirements, the place of employment, the period of employment, and all other terms and conditions of employment are the same. It is our understanding that prior to the TLC portion of this rule going into effect, employers were generally only filing applications with DHS for one or two workers, and that's fine if that's all the workers you're requiring, but if you're requesting 10 or 15 workers who are doing the same job under the same conditions of employment in the same location, it's more efficient both for employers and for OFLC if you submit an application that that covers all of your workers rather than just some of them. The review process for TLC applications is similar for those of you who are familiar with our H-2B program is similar to that. So upon receiving the application, the first step taken by CNPC is to issue either a notice of acceptance or a notice of deficiency called a NOAA or a NOD. A NOD is issued when the application contains errors or inaccuracies or otherwise does not meet the program requirements. And when a NOD is issued, it's a letter that will explain why the application is deficient. It will offer 10 business days from the date of the letter to submit a modified application, and it will inform the filer that failure to submit a modified application will result in denial of the application. When a NOD response is submitted, the CO will review the modified application, and it may either issue an additional NOD or it may issue a NOAA if all of the problems have been rectified. An additional NOD will generally be issued where the employer has mostly addressed the issues in the NOD, but there may be one or two minor things that still need to be fixed. If the employer submits a modified application that still substantially fails to comply with the program requirements, the case may be denied at that point. So those are the sort of the three steps. I mean, usually it will either be an additional NOD or a NOAA, but depending on what's resubmitted, it could be denied right there. The CO issues a NOAA at the point an application does not contain any errors or inaccuracies and meets the program requirements. So that might be upon first review, or again, it may be after an application is corrected through a NOD. The NOAA directs the employer to recruit U.S. workers, requires the employer's recruitment to begin within 14 calendar days of the NOAA's date, and requires the employer to submit a recruitment report to the Chicago MPC by the date specified in the NOAA. The employer may make certain amendments during the time that the application is pending. Those amendments may include increasing the number of workers without requiring additional recruitment, and it may include making minor changes to the period of employment of up to 14 days. Amendments after the certification are issued are not permitted. If something substantially needs to be changed after the certification is submitted, the employer would need to withdraw the certification and submit a new application. Upon issuance of the NOAA, again, the employer will commence the recruitment of U.S. workers, and according to the instructions in the NOAA, must do the following. Begin recruitment within 14 calendar days. Place an advertisement of the job on the CNMI Department of Labor's job listing system for 21 consecutive days. Post notice at two locations at the employer's place of business for 21 consecutive days. Conduct any additional recruitment ordered by the certifying officer and contact former U.S. workers. If interviews are required for the job, those interviews must be conducted using a procedure that has little or no cost to workers. The employer must consider and hire all U.S. workers who are applied, are qualified, and available for the job. They must complete the recruitment process, and they must prepare and submit the recruitment report, again, by the date specified by the CO. Recruitment of U.S. workers must not contain terms and conditions of employment that are less favorable to U.S. workers than those offered to CW1 workers. They must comply with all job offer assurances. The advertisement must have the following information: the employer's name and contact number, job title, total number of job openings, description of the job opportunity with sufficient information to apprise applicants, such as job duties, minimum education and experience, work hours and days, anticipated start and end dates, specific places of employment, and the wage that is being offered. If applicable, the job advertisements also must include overtime pay, the frequency of pay. Overtime must be specified if it's applicable. Frequency of pay must always be listed, as must the deductions required by law, a summary of the 3/4 guarantee, an indication that travel and subsistence will be paid for those who complete 50% of the job order, and if applicable, state that the employer will provide the worker with all tools, supplies, and equipment necessary to perform the duties assigned. I mentioned the 3/4 guarantee, which is something that that is specified in more detail in the IFR, but just a quick overview of what it is that it's basically a worker protection that requires the employer to guarantee that in no circumstances will the worker be paid any less than 3/4 of all of the hours offered in the job opportunity. So, for example, if the employer is seeking a CW1 visa for 12 months and is offering 40 hours per week, the 3/4 guarantee means that they're under no circumstances will the employer pay or will the worker receive less than pay for 9 months of the year at 40 hours per week. So it's both meant to ensure that that workers taking the job are guaranteed at least a basic level of pay, and also to ensure that the employer is reasonably certain that it really has this need and has enough business to justify using the CW1 program, because it is requiring itself to, it's committing itself and obligating itself to pay for at least 3/4 of the hours worked, although the expectation is certainly that employers will offer all of the hours that are on the job opportunity and will, you know, will have the actual full opportunity that they need. The following additional assurances and advertising contents must also be included. Any board, lodging, or other facilities that will be offered to assist, that will either be offered to workers or that workers will be assisted in securing. So if the employer has a place where it will allow all of its workers to live, that needs to be in the job advertisements. And if the employer makes it a practice to help employees find suitable housing, that should also be listed. On-the-job training must be listed if that's offered, and the advertisements absolutely must instruct all applicants to apply directly with the employer and must provide at least 2 verifiable methods by which applicants may apply for the job opportunity, one of which must be electronic, as well as the days and hours during which applicants may be interviewed. So the employer can provide a mailing address or an email address for a worker to apply, but what the employer can't do is tell the worker that they must either apply by mail or in person. There must be one electronic means of applying. And just one other thing I want to mention, or just to be clear. So as I've mentioned about both 9141C and 9142C, everything needs to be filed electronically with us, and we will electronically communicate with employers. So everything is a two-way electronic communication. Advertisements must be posted for 21 consecutive calendar days, meet the requirements specified in the regulations, and must be documented with printouts of web pages, verifiable evidence from the CNMI Department of Labor containing advertising content, and the dates of publication. Former U.S. workers who were employed in the occupation at the place of employment must be contacted, except those U.S. workers dismissed for cause or who abandoned the place of employment. And the contact must be during the advertisement period. So, you know, you can't contact former workers today and tell us in the recruitment report that they weren't interested. You must contact them during the 21-day recruitment period, and all U.S. workers who were laid off within 270 calendar days of the date of need must be contacted. And you must document this. Even if you have reason to believe that certain workers don't want to return, you do need to confirm that. Again, a copy of the application. So I mentioned earlier, a posting in two locations for 21 consecutive days, and what must be posted is a printed out copy of the 9142C that's filed with CNPC. And if the employer typically uses some sort of electronic posting to inform its workers of important things, then that's available. You may do that here with the internal posting. And the employer must maintain proof of posting, including the location and times of posting. At the CO's discretion, the CO may also require additional reasonable recruitment steps if they have reason to believe that there are workers available for a specific type of job, and this is very much at the CO's discretion. Additional recruiting may include things like a posting on the employer's website or another website, contacting a community-based organization or a union, or using a professional or ethnic publication. Once the advertising is complete, a recruitment report must be prepared, signed, dated, and submitted by the employer. And the recruitment report cannot be submitted any fewer than 2 days after the last date of the advertisement. The recruitment report must contain the name of each recruitment activity or source, the name and contact information of each U.S. worker who applied or was referred to the job, and whether the worker accepted or declined the job, confirmation that the advertisement was placed on the CNMI Department of Labor website, confirmation that former U.S. workers were contacted, and the means and dates of contact, and confirmation that the employer posted the notice of the job opportunity. If directed by the CEO, the employer must also account for additional recruitment methods, and the employer must state the reason each U.S. worker who was qualified for the job was not hired. Failure to provide the recruitment report will lead to the application being denied, and the employer must maintain the information related to recruitment for the occupation, and the retention requirements are something that we will discuss a little bit later. The CO will certify the application only if the employer has met all certification requirements. Those requirements include that the employer has complied with all of the necessary recruitment steps that we've just discussed, has determined that there are insufficient U.S. workers in CNMI to fill the employer's job opportunity, and please note that the CO will count as available any U.S. worker who was applied for, who was denied or rejected for other than lawful job-related reasons. Once the CO makes a determination, they will certify the application, deny the application, or issue a partial certification. If the case is certified, the CO will electronically send a final determination notice and a copy of the certified application to the employer and a copy, if applicable, to the employer's agent or attorney. For employers permitted to file by mail, the CO will send everything by first-class mail back to them. And as I mentioned, if the employer files electronically, then all communication will be done electronically with the employer, and the employer needs to retain a copy of the certified application, including the original signed appendix. If the application is denied, the CO will electronically file a The CO will electronically send a final determination notice to the employer, and again, a copy if applicable to the agent or attorney. And again, if the case is submitted by mail, the denial letter will be sent by mail. Otherwise, it will be done electronically. And a denial letter will state the reasons for the denial, including the relevant regulatory standards, offer the opportunity to request administrative review by the department's Board of Alien Labor Certification Appeals, and explain that failure to request such review will result in the denial becoming final. There will be no reconsideration or other appeal short of a request for administrative review. A partial certification is a certification. However, it reduces either the period of employment or the number of workers that are approved to for the CW1 TLC. And again, this is where any U.S. worker who is unlawfully rejected will be counted against the certification. So for each worker that is unlawfully rejected, the number of certified positions will be reduced by one. If a partial cert is issued, the CO will send a letter explaining the partial cert and will otherwise use the procedures for issuing a certification. Now, I mentioned the period of need may also be decreased. We expect most employers will apply for a year. So, and it's unlikely that the period of need will be decreased. So in most cases, a partial certification will be a reduction of the number of U.S. workers. And when a partial cert is issued, there will be, similar to with the denial, an explanation of why the reduction has been made, cite the relevant regulatory standards, offer the opportunity for administrative review by BALCA, and explain that failure to request such a review will result in the partial certification becoming final. There will be no reconsideration or other appeal of the CO's decision to issue a partial cert short of a BALCA review. So if a partial certification is issued, the employer can either accept it or request a BALCA review. The validity period, again, will be for up to 1 year, except for, or, you know, whatever the employer requests, up to 1 year, except in the case of long-term workers for which a three-year certification can be issued. The certification is valid only for the number of CW1 positions approved, only valid at the place of employment noted on the TLC, and for the job classification and duties specified on the application, and for the employer that receives it. So a TLC is very specific, and it is only applicable to the people who file it for the job described in the place described. A certification may not be transferred from one employer to another unless there is a successor in interest where one employer succeeds the other in a legally defined way. Who is required to retain documents? All CW1 employers are required to retain documents and records that establish compliance with the CW1 program. The period of retention is for 3 years from the latest date of any of the following: 3 years from the date that the certification expires, 3 days from the final determination if the application is denied, and 3 years from the receipt of a request for withdrawal by the department if the employer requests that the application be withdrawn. What should be retained? Proof of recruitment efforts, including the job order placed with the CNMI Department of Labor, proof of contact of U.S. workers, the internal posting notice, and additional employer-conducted recruitment when required by the CO. The documentation supporting the application, records of each worker's earnings, hours offered and worked, locations where work is performed, and other information. If applicable, records of reimbursement or transportation and subsistence costs incurred by workers. Copies of written contracts with third parties demonstrating compliance with the prohibitions against seeking or receiving payments or other compensation from prospective workers, and proof of contact with U.S. workers. A written notice notifying OFLC that a CW1 worker or worker in corresponding employment has separated from employment before the end dates of employment. So if an employer leaves voluntarily or is fired for some reason, that must be documented and retained. And a copy of the prevailing wage determination, the TLC application, any amendments or extensions, and the signed Appendix C. Please note that this documentation must be made available to the Department of Labor, the Department of Homeland Security, or any federal government issue performing any sort of investigation, inspection, audit, law enforcement function, or the like. I'm now going to turn it over to my colleague, Liana, who will talk about the post-certification activities and continue with the rest of the presentation.
Thanks, Brian. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. So I'm going to talk about the post-certification activities. Within this topic, we're going to cover extension, administrative review, withdrawal, and public disclosure. What are the basis for extending the period of employment? Basically, within this category, we're going to be considering weather conditions, other factors beyond the control of the employer, like, for example, if we're seeing changes in market conditions. The extension must be in writing, submitted electronically, unless OFLC has allowed the employer to file or submit the application by mail, as we have explained before, and provide supporting documentation. The CO will notify the employer of the decision in writing. The employer may appeal a decision. Obligations during the period of extension, such as all assurances and obligations under the certification, continue to apply. The employer must immediately provide CW1 workers and workers in corresponding employment with a copy of an approved extension. So how to request an administrative review? An appeal must be filed with BALCA. The request must be received by BALCA and the CO within 10 days from the date of determination. Clearly identify the particular determination for which review is sought. And this is something that's important to take into consideration in the event that the employer files more than one TLC with OFLC. It should also include a copy of CO's determination, set forth a particular ground for the request, and contain only evidence that was actually before the CO at the time the determination was made. So what follows? The CO will provide a copy of the appeal filed to BALCA, the employer and associate solicitor for employment and training at the Department of Labor. The chief administrative law judge will immediately assign either a single member or a three-member panel of BALCA to consider a particular case. If the employer wishes to submit its brief on appeal, it must do so as part of its request for review. Within 7 days of receipt of the appeal file, counsel for the CO may submit a brief in support of the CO's decision and, if applicable, in response to the employer's brief. So what is the standard of review? BALCA must uphold the CO's decision unless shown by the employer to be arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with the law. The scope of the review. BALCA will affirm, reverse, or modify the CO's determination or remand to the CO for further action. BALCA will consider the documents in the appeal, the request for review, and any legal briefs submitted. It may not consider evidence not before the CO at the time of determination, even if such evidence is in the appeal file, request for review, or the legal brief. Decision. BALCA must specify the reasons for the action taken and provide this decision to the employer, the CO, and counsel for the CO within 7 days of the submission of the CO's brief or 10 business days after receipt of the appeal file, whichever is later, using a method normally ensuring next day delivery. The employer may withdraw the application after it has been submitted to the Center for Processing, including after the CO has granted certification. A request to withdraw must be in writing, identifying the application and filed with the Center. After withdrawal, the employer is still obligated to comply with the terms and conditions of employment as stated in the application and work contract, with respect to all workers recruited and hired. The employer must also comply with the documentation requirements that we discussed before. The department will maintain an electronic file accessible to the public with CW1 application disclosure information. The data will include information from the application, such as the employer's information, number of workers requested, the date filed, the date decided, and the final disposition. Now we're going to cover the integrity measures that are part of this post-certification activities. We're going to be discussing audits, assisted recruitment, revocation, and debarment. Audits. Audits are discretionary action by the CO. The CO will send a letter to the employer and, if applicable, to its attorney or agent, which will specify the documents that must be submitted in response, include the date, no more than 30 calendar days from the date in the letter, by which documents must be received by the CO, and advice that failure to comply with the audit process may result in assisted recruitment or revocation. Supplemental information request. During an audit examination, the CO may request supplemental information and audit documentation from the employer to complete the audit. If circumstances warrant, the CO can issue one or more requests for supplemental information. In addition to audits, assisted recruitment, revocation, and debarment actions, employers must be aware that the CO may decide to provide the audit findings and underlined information to other enforcement agencies, such as DHS. The CO may refer to any findings establishing that an employer discouraged a qualified U.S. worker from applying or failed to hire, discharge, or otherwise discriminated against a qualified U.S. worker to the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, Immigrant and Employee Rights Division. Assisted recruitment. The CO determines that a violation has occurred which doesn't warrant debarment. The CO will notify in writing the employer and attorney or agent, if applicable, that assisted recruitment will be required for a period of up to 2 years from the day the notice is issued. This notice will include the reasons for imposing additional requirements, state employer's agreement to accept the conditions, will constitute the inclusion as bona fide conditions in terms of an application, and offer the employer an opportunity to request an administrative review. Assisted recruitment will be in addition to any recruitment required of the employer and may consist of, but is not limited to, requiring the employer to comply with one or more of the following. draft advertisements to CO for review and approval, designate sources where employer must recruit for U.S. workers and CNMI, and direct employer to advertise to such sources. Extend length of advertisement, notify CO when advertisements are placed, perform additional assistive recruitment, provide proof of publication of all advertisements, documentation of all U.S. workers who apply, and proof of contact with all referrals and past year workers, and or provide any additional documentation verifying that the employer conducted assisted recruitment steps directed by the CO. An important note that we're going to make in here is that material failure to comply with requirements ordered by the CO will result in a denial of the certification and debarment. Revocation. The OFLC administrator may revoke an approved TLC if the OFLC administrator finds the issuance of the TLC was not justified due to fraud or misrepresentation of a material fact in the application process. The employer substantially failed to comply with any of the terms or the conditions of the approved TLC. A substantial failure is a significant deviation from the terms and conditions of the approved certification that is further defined in Section 655.473D. Or the employer impeded the audit process or impeded any federal government official performing an investigation, inspection, audit, or law enforcement function. Revocation procedures basically consists of a notice of revocation that we're going to refer to as the employer and its attorney or agent, if applicable, with grounds of revocation informing about the right to submit rebuttal evidence or request administrative review by BACA. Rebuttal evidence must be submitted within 10 business days from the date of the notice. Otherwise, the notice will become the final agency action and will take effect at the end of the 10 business day period. Request for review. An employer may appeal a revocation or a final determination of the OFLC administrator to BACA after the review of rebuttal evidence. BACA's decision is the final agency action. The timely submission of a rebuttal evidence or a request for administrative review will stay the revocation pending the outcome of the proceeding. If the TLC is revoked, the OFLC administrator will provide copies of final revocation decisions to DHS and the Department of State promptly. What are the employer's obligations under these circumstances? An employer's TLC is revoked. The employer is responsible for reimbursement of actual inbound transportation and other expenses, the workers' outbound transportation expenses, payment to the workers of the amount due under the 3/4 warranty, and any other wages, benefits, and working conditions due or owing to the workers under 20 CFR 655 subpart E. Debarment. OFLC may debar an employer, agent, attorney, or any successor in interest to that employer, agent, or attorney from participating in the CW1 program for up to 5 years per individual violation if the OFLC administrator finds there was a violation of a material term or condition of the application for the prevailing wage determination or application for temporary employment certification. OFLC would promptly provide copies of the final debarment decisions to DHS and the Department of State. Debarment from the CW1 program applies to all of the department's employer-based board and labor programs. The debarred employer or a debarred agent or attorney or any successor in interest to any debarred employer, agent, or attorney will be disqualified from filing any labor certification applications or labor condition applications with the department subject to the term limit. If such an application is filed, it will be denied without review. What's a violation in the context of debarment? One or more acts of commission or omission on the part of the employer or the employer's agent or attorney that involve failure to pay or provide the required wages, benefits, or working conditions to employers, CW1 workers, and or workers in corresponding employment. Failure, except for lawful job-related reasons, to offer employment to qualified youth workers who apply for the job. To qualify for the job. I'm going to read it again. Federal except for lawful job-related reasons to offer employment to qualified youth workers who apply for the job opportunity for recertification was sought. Failure to comply with employers' obligations to recruit youth workers, improper layoff or displacement of youth workers or workers in corresponding employment. Failure to comply with the NOD process as set forth in 655-431 or the assisted recruitment process as set forth in 655.471 or of 20 CFR 655 subpart E. Impending the audit process or impending any federal government official performing an investigation, inspection, audit, or law enforcement function. Also, employing a CW1 worker outside of the Commonwealth in an activity or activities not listed in work contract or outside the validity period of employment of the work contract, including any approved extension thereof. Also, a violation of the requirements of Section 655.423N or O. A violation of any of the provisions listed in Section 655.23 or any other act showing such flagrant disregard for the law that future compliance with the program requirements cannot reasonably be expected. Remember, one violation is sufficient to prompt the department action. What's a violation in the context of the department? Fraud involving application for prevailing wage determination or the application for temporary employment certification or a material misrepresentation of fact during the course of processing the application for temporary employment certification. What is a substantial violation? To determine that a substantial violation has occurred, certain factors such as those listed below must be considered. Previous history of a violation or violations under the CW1 program, the number of CW1 workers, workers in corresponding employment, or U.S. workers who were and are affected by the violation, or violation, the gravity of the violation or violation, or the extent to which the violator achieved a financial gain due to the violation or violations, or the potential financial loss or potential injury to the worker or workers. Now we're going to cover the debarment procedures. Notice of debarment. OFLC will issue a notice of debarment stating the reasons for the debarment finding, including a detailed explanation of the grounds for and the duration of the debarment and informing the party subject to the notice of its right to submit rebuttal evidence or to request administrative review of the decision by BALCA. If the party doesn't file rebuttal evidence or a request for review within 30 calendar days of the date of the notice of debarment, the notice is the final agency action and the debarment will take effect on the date specified in the notice or, if not date specified, at the end of the 30 calendar days. The timely filing of rebuttal evidence or a request for review stays the debarment pending the outcome of the appeal. The party may submit evidence to rebut the grounds stated in the notice in 30 days of the date the notice is issued. If rebuttal evidence is timely filed, OFLC will issue a final determination on the debarment within 30 calendar days of receiving the rebuttal evidence. If OFLC upholds the debarment, it will inform the party of its right to request administrative review of the debarment by BALCA. The appeal must occur within 30 calendar days after the date of the final determination, or the final determination will be the final agency order and the debarment will take effect on the date specified in the final determination or at the end of the 30 calendar days. Request for administrative review, debarment appeal. Debarment appeal must be submitted within 30 calendar days of the date of the notice of debarment or the date of the final determination by the OFLC administrator after review of rebuttal evidence submitted. Must be sent in writing to the Chief ALJ, United States Department of Labor, with a simultaneous copy served on to the OFLC administrator. The request must clearly identify the particular environmental determination for which review is sought and must set forth a particular ground for the request. If no timely request for review is filed, the debarment will take effect on the date specified in the notice of debarment or final determination, or if no date is specified, 30 calendar days from the date the notice of debarment or final determination is issued. Upon receipt of a request for review, the OFLC administrator will present a certified copy of the ETA case file to the chief ALJ by means normally assuring expedited delivery. The chief ALJ will immediately assign an ALJ to conduct a review. Statements, briefs, and other submissions of the parties must contain only legal argument and only such evidence that was within the record upon which the debarment was based, including any rebuttal evidence submitted pursuant to paragraph S2 of this session. The ALJ must afford all parties 30 calendar days to submit or decline to submit any appropriate statement of decision or legal brief. The review of the environment determination, the basis of the record upon which the decision was made, the request for review, and any statements of decision or legal brief submitted. The ALJ's final determination must affirm, reverse, or modify the OFLC administrator's determination be provided to the parties by first class mail, and is also the final agency action unless either party within 30 calendar days of the ALJ's decision seeks review of the decision with the Administrative Review Board. Review of the debarment appeals by the ARB. A party has 30 calendar days from the decision of the ALJ to petition the ARB to review a decision. Copies of the petition must be served on all parties and on the ALJ. The ARB will decide whether to accept the petition within 30 calendar days of receipt. If the ARB declines to accept the petition, or if the ARB doesn't issue a notice accepting a petition within 30 calendar days after the receipt of the timely filing of the petition, the decision of the ALJ is the final agency action. If a petition for review is accepted, the decision of the ALJ will be stayed unless and until the ARB issues an order affirming the decision. The ARB must serve notice of its decision to accept or not to accept the petition upon the ALJ and upon all parties to the proceeding. Upon receipt of the ARB's notice to accept the petition, the Office of Administrative Law Judges will promptly forward a copy of the complete appeal record to the ARB. Where the ARB has determined to review the decision and order, the ARB will notify each party of the issue or issues raised, the form in which the submissions must be made, for example, briefs or oral argument, and the time within which the presentation must be submitted. The ARB's final decision must be issued within 90 calendar days from the notice granting the petition and served upon all parties and the ALJ. Upon public notice from DHS, USCIS, that is, has received a sufficient number of CW1 petitions to meet the CW1 statutory cap, OFLC will continue to process any TLC's applications that are currently in process with the department and return any additional CW1 TLC applications submitted for the current fiscal year. OFLC will provide notice that it will cease accepting CW1 TLC applications for the current fiscal year on the OFLC website at www.foreignlaborcert.doleta.gov. The notice will be effective on the date of publication and will remain effective for the remainder of the fiscal year unless USCIS and OFLC publish additional notice or notice. So we have listed a number of important links that will be available also on our website for your reference and information. So we highly recommend that everybody interested actually access this information, where we have listed, you know, the links, you know, for the specific webpage that we have developed for the program, put flag, you know, the system that Brian mentioned before where everyone can take a look and, you know, and prepare for filing eventually. And we have listed also information through which you can contact the National Processing Wage Center and the Chicago National Processing Center.
Thank you, Liana. I'm just going to give a couple of closing remarks. First of all, I would note that the most important website to come to, and we're going to leave this slide up for the rest of the presentation, but I would encourage everybody to copy the Foreign Labor Certification website, because from that you can find all of the other things, such as how to sign into FLAG, how to contact that various help desks and things like that. Also, as I noted earlier, we will be continually posting information on the Foreign Labor Cert web, the OFLC website, which is foreignlaborcert.doleta.gov. We have, if you go to the CW1 page, and there's a tab for that at the top of the website, there's a bunch of helpful information. This presentation will eventually be posted there. We can't send it to individuals, but it will be posted publicly for everybody. And actually, if you go there now, there are a series of videos that were added under the additional resources tab, which will walk you through all of the steps of signing up for an account in FLAG and how to work through the FLAG system and fill it out. And in the next couple of days, we will also be putting up user guides, which instead of the videos are just written sort of versions of what's in the video so that you can see step by step how to do things. One thing that I saw is somebody asking if a U.S. citizen employee was terminated due to poor performance, if they still need to be recruited and they or contacted, and they do not. As I mentioned earlier in the presentation, you only have to contact U.S. workers who are in good standing. So any employee who was terminated for cause is not a U.S. worker that is considered to be in good standing, and you do not need to contact them. It's only workers who either were laid off because you didn't have business anymore or for any other, you know, various reasons why they were in good standing when they left you, but they didn't continue employment. And I think those are probably all the questions that I saw in here. As I noted, we can't email these out to individuals. The other thing I would say is that we are going to hold another one of these webinars on Monday, April 1st, or Tuesday, April 2nd, CNMI time. The subject matter that we're going to cover is basically the same. It's going to be the same presentation. We may make small tweaks after having gone through this, but we're not going to cover anything different. But certainly if you want to hear this again, if you think hearing it a second time, we invite you to come to that second webinar. We want to contact as many people as possible. So if you have any colleagues who you think would benefit from this webinar, please forward this information to them. We would like to distribute this as widely as possible, and OFLC will be engaging in other outreach activities, but this is the first step, and these are really the only two outreach activities that we will have time to engage in before the rule goes into effect on April 4th. So, you know, there's plenty of information on our website, but we would like to have as many people on these webinars as possible so that we can disseminate information about the program, because hopefully the format we're providing it in is a little more user-friendly than the very technical nature of the IFR, which, you know, has to be technical for any number of reasons. But one other thing, too, I noticed as Liana was doing her presentation that She started talking a lot about mail when the application is appealed. And I stated earlier that all of the applications that are filed electronically, we will continue contacting you electronically. And that is true through the final determination stage. But once an application is appealed to BALCA, that's no longer controlled by OFLC. That's controlled by the department's administrative law judges. And unfortunately, they do not accept electronic filings. So at the point that an application is appealed, unfortunately, it does have to be done by mail. And I think Leona has something she wants to add.
I just wanted to add something with regards to the question of contacting former employees. Like, just a reminder, it's also covered during our presentation, that the requirement of regulations is that this contact is documented. You know, like Brian was saying, if it's, you know, for other reasons, they're not specifying the regulations, keep that into consideration. But is the requirement on the regulations that, you know, the contacts be covered as part of the report. The other thing that I wanted to point out is just emphasize that, as Brian, as you mentioned, like to go to the main page, our main page is foreignlaborcert.doleta.gov, because we are in the process of posting a lot of helpful information, and that, you know, that would be the main point. But we're not covering, you know, the process that is to be followed then with USCIS. For that, we're also listing in this presentation a link to the website, www.uscis.gov. And so you might visit the website for information about actually how to file the petition with USCIS.
Yes, and I believe USCIS also has a dedicated CW1 page. And I would also just say that we are going to be uploading or updating our website on a rolling basis fairly frequently as this process rolls out. So I would encourage you to frequently check our website, because there will be lots of additional information. And there may not be, you know, you've seen that there are some announcements if you've gone to our website on the homepage, but we're not necessarily going to always post an announcement for every update, because that just wouldn't really be all that efficient. So I would just contact our website regularly and or check it regularly.
We could also want to have a reminder, so because we see that the people are in system, and you know, we like the fact that our, you know, presentation is popular, but you know, just a reminder too that you should look at the Federal Register for, you know, announcements on the regulations, so that you can get a hold of, you know, the information and public inspection.
Although what's what's on the Federal Register is also linked to on our website. The only difference between what's on the Federal Register and what's on our website is that there are dates that will be added when it's officially published on Monday, but mm-hmm. The substance is the same. And if you read the preamble, that sort of has more of a narrative to explain how we interpret and will plan to apply the regulation. So that could also be helpful if you have specific questions. And again, if you have additional questions, we would encourage you to, I know it's an hour and a half, but we would encourage you to join us again on Monday. And I think that is it. We thank you very much for your time, for joining us. And again, please pass along the information to anybody that you think would be helped by either visiting our website or attending the webinar on Monday evening our time or Tuesday morning your time. Thank you very much, and good morning or good evening.